sorry.
My dryer.
That's okay.
Let's see, I started to talk about going to the Casals Festival in France when we spoke last time,
mm-hmm.
through my studies of Bach interpretation with Gieron Alexanian and the fact that I had once met Alexander Schneider. So the first season, since I didn't have much to play, I became a kind of factotum, being almost bilingual. I never learned to speak Catalan, but having lived with my father's family in Paris, I was beginning to speak French reasonably fluently. And then in other years, I went back either as in the orchestra or librarian, and when there was just chamber music one year. And I have notebooks of all the wonderful things he said, what Casals said in rehearsals, and sometimes I tell them to those of my colleagues in the symphony that I think are receptive and have certainly used that as in my own teaching and conducting. He said, for example, Bach is a volcano. Every note must have juice. He said, each musical phrase is like a face. It changes as we, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and we don't say a sentence, la 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 la, from beginning and middle to the end. We have a beginning and a middle and a climax and an end. And every phrase has to do that. And he used to always talk, Casals always talked about the rainbow in each phrase, the shape of each phrase. So one day I went to him, probably, and asked him, say, Maître Casals, why did you choose the picture of the rainbow to describe the phrase? He said, well, because it's a curve and top. But does it have anything to do? Do you refer to the pact between God and Noah and mankind, and that the rainbow is a symbol of his love? He said, yes, that great music is for, he said, for him, the manifestation of God's love. One day, at the first festival, we were recording a concerto for oboe and violin. Marcel Tapiteau, the great oboist of the Philadelphia Orchestra, was there, and Isaac Stern was the violin soloist, and we were all sitting in the refectory of the girls' college, of girls' school, if not a college, with the old plaster walls hung with drapes and carpeting that people of the town had donated to try to help the acoustics for the recording. And the equipment of the engineers out in the trailer. So it was extraordinarily beautiful, especially the slow moving. But when the red light went off, saying that the machine would stop at the end of the second movement, a friend of Casals, a minister from Switzerland, well up in years, stood up and said, and this was the atmosphere in which this could happen, excuse the interruption of an old man. That was so beautiful, I had to ask myself whether I was still here or whether I'd gone on. And Casals looked at him, didn't get off the phone, but looked at him and said, remember Minister Christian. Last year we were walking in Switzerland, and we came upon a tree that was so beautiful that I said to you, are we here or are we in heaven? And you answered me, dear friend Casals, let us never forget that God who made heaven made the earth as well. I can't tell stories like that to my younger colleagues because I don't give a damn. And music doesn't mean that to them. I guess that through the kinds of people I've known, I'm also an anachronism. But my own mother said the wisest thing, the most insightful thing I've ever heard about music, and proves that a lot of the super intellectuals and philosophers about aesthetics are fools. We were listening, I was visiting after the symphony season was over, and we were listening to the radio. There was only one station that had a so-called good music hour at that time in St. Louis, and it was Mozart A Major Piano Concerto. So we were chatting, my father and my mother and I. When the slow movement started, it was really so beautiful that we stopped talking to listen. And when it was over, my mother said, what an outlook on life. She was a very perceptive lady. I told that to Pat and he started to cry. So those who say that music is just sound in time and with no meaning,
sounds like a very lovely experience that you had with Casals and the Casals Festival and the different people that you met there.
Yes, yes.
That Casals stood out. He was the important figure.
Oh yes, because he, after all, he was the one who drew all these musicians to him, as Fritz Krasser said, the noblest man who ever drew a bow. He was a tough guy in his own way, you know, about money. But he felt he should be paid what he was worth.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, who supported those concerts?
Essentially, Columbia Records. Yes, the French government cooperated, but almost everything was recorded for the first 3 years. The fourth year, only one thing was recorded. We wanted to record more, but some of the musicians who were new to that festival didn't feel cooperative. They said they were paid for a certain recording, and that's all they would do. Too bad. The in following years, I think the French government helped, but there were no more recording contracts. In Puerto Rico, when the festivals were begun, the Puerto Rican government and some big donors helped. I think there were also some very big donors in Paris, like the Rothschilds and La Comtesse Pastre of the Noyau Prop Vermouth and other. The Gouin family of the locomotive, the manufactured locomotives over there. And I think there was some money from French radio. I don't know, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
In case.
Mm-hmm.
And the church gave rent. Allowed.
Mm-hmm. It attracted many people.
Oh my, in the early years it was just, the village was packed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. because Casals hadn't played in public for years. Stopped his travel.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, at a dinner in Switzerland, Paul Tochtelier, the French cellist, was there. And Albert Schweitzer was being honored, I think, at that dinner. He came over to Casals' table and told him he was wrong. That if he wanted to protest against the Franco government, he had to go out and play all over the world and remind people. So then he began to do that.
Did you meet Albert Schweitzer?
No, I regret. I never met him. After all, when the Casals festivals began there, Casals was already 73. He had a long, long career already in back of him. And then, in Puerto Rico in 1957, he became ill and then married one of his pupils and started over. So that from about, let's see, he was born in 76 and he got married in about 57 or 58.
Something. 77?
Yes, it was going on 80.
Mm-hmm.
Had
he been married before?
Yes, but he and his wife didn't do so well together and it was separated for, I don't know how many years. So he's practically started over, you know, with Puerto Rico as his home base instead of Spain or wherever. Paris, and a girl approximately 60 years his junior. But brilliant.
They had music in common.
Not only that, Casals' mother was born in a certain house in a village in Puerto Rico on a certain day of the month, and so was the mother of that of his wife. The same town, same house, same day.
Oh,
obviously not the same year.
Well, that is an enormous coincidence.
Isn't that? But she had been a pupil of his.
I suppose now, is she musically involved now?
Yes. After a while, after Casals' death, she married Eugene Istomin, who was a protege of Casals, and is the musical director of the Kennedy Center in Washington. Brilliant, brilliant. Ooh. My gosh. She graduated high school and college the same day.
Well, she must have been a very exceptional person.
Oh, yes. Yes, she's very lovely. Beautiful, absolutely the quintessence of Puerto Rican beauty.
Well, that was a lovely way to end his life then.
Yes, yes.
Person.
Let me show you my look at the resemblance.
His mother is just beautiful.
And he had some sort of emanation, so people would come in not feeling well, and after talking with him for 5 minutes, not about themselves, but there was something coming out of him, they went out feeling good.
Isn't that
healthy, yeah.
Interesting.
And he had that same effect on himself, mostly. Because his niece said that, you know, in that little town in southern France, there was a little heat. It would get cold and he would go to bed. So he was from southern, from Spain. And then he would get out of bed. Somebody would give him a cello. And he just looked to be terrible. In a half an hour, he was in good shape and playing well. His hands were like separate entities. They were always warm and full of life. These are the same hands that at one of Franco's generals posted signs with the price on for those hands. So, you know, I don't mean to brag. It's not me. I just have had such extraordinarily good fortune to have been in contact with these people. But I frankly feel that, when, especially in my teaching and conducting, that I can be a link to the great musical thinking of the past, and perhaps the more humanistic traditions. I was talking with my partner in the orchestra, Marty Lerner, about Steinberg's Beethoven and Previn's. And I said, after all, Previn is so enormously gifted. Why is it not like good like Steinberg? It's not much. He said, it's a matter of belief. Steinberg, after all, was formed in the early part of the 20th century, the residue of the 19th, and his mother was a pupil of the famous German composer Joachim Raff, so there's a musical tradition that's very long. And Previn is post-World War II, I say, you know, how is it possible to believe in classical music after the Holocaust? I suppose when one reads, you know, about what the musicians did in the concentration camps, you know that we have to go on and continue to believe. I went to Casals one day and I said, what's the point? I'm not such a great talent, you know, that I'm going to offer the world something like you do. Don't you think I ought to do something else, to go out preaching people to make peace or something? He said, no, whatever you can do, we need music more, because it's harder, life and civilization is more precarious.
Yes, that is, I can see that after the Holocaust, how can you have the same feeling, the attitude?
Yes, did Beethoven Ninth save one life? Mm-hmm. You see, when we were in Berlin, and playing in the Berlin Philharmonic Hall, the pictures of Furtwängler, great conductor, great blah blah, conducting, and then there in the front row is Hitler, Goebbels, and Goering, Beethoven, whatever it was. Wagner, we know, was the night of some damn cool. He just bit the hands that fed him. Like Meyerbeer in Paris. He wasn't content to accept help. He wanted to push him down. But he was sure.
Well, then, when you attended these festivals, it wasn't just music that you spoke about, it was politics.
Oh, yes, politics, of course. Oh, yes. And yes, larger issues of art in society, music in society, you know.
Yes, that was very interesting, the philosophy of art.
Because music, after all, is a function of society. Music is changing in Pittsburgh, as you asked before, because life in Pittsburgh is different. we can't do with two concerts a week. We have to have three performances a week because of this, the, you know, they're more educated people here. And you know, the proportion of blue collar and what would you call them?
Professions.
Yeah, well, yeah, of professionals, it's really changed. The service people and all that, and the people who are blue collar people. After all, we have public education. It's all making a difference over the years. We complained about Europe, but Europe doesn't have the broad democratic base of art appreciation we have here.
You mentioned too that there was a difference in education. The education that people had before and what they have now, that would make a difference too. Now it seems like more people want to attend concerts, but are the musicians as well trained?
Oh, I think that as far as technical capabilities, musicians are superior now. But unfortunately, many of those people of the great humanist tradition are not around. And in America, we admire the technical. And I must say, in all frankness, that so many of the finest players were drained off to places like Hollywood and the Jingle Studios in New York. So instead of devoting their gifts to playing so-called, or what we call great art music, play background music for shows, for movies and stuff like that. That's where the big money was. I suppose for what few people are still doing it, it still is. We used to have when I first came, there was a clarinet player from California, and who was first clarinet in Disney Studios. He wanted to play music, he came with Reiner, and then went to Chicago and couldn't stand the weather and went back to Southern California. But we'd go to we'd say, "Hi, how are you today, Mitch? Good. We went to the movies last night." "Yeah? What'd you see? So-and-so. How'd you like that clarinet playing?" Can you imagine going to a movie to hear the clarinet playing? But, you know, that's a different mentality. Happened to be himself. So, now, since 1947, I've been in Pittsburgh, and I expect to finish my career as an orchestra player here. Hopefully I can do some other things and continue to contribute to the musical life of the city.
What other things do you expect to do?
Oh, maybe play some more, do more chamber music playing. I don't know if anybody will want me to do any conducting after I was associate conductor of the Pittsburgh Youth Symphony for 30 years.
What other groups have you been associated with in Pittsburgh?
And I was founding conductor of the Three Rivers Training Orchestra. And for, I don't know how many years, I conducted the Duquesne University Orchestra and offered workshops.
What got you into conducting?
Oh, just again, my admiration for my brother, who was in music education, and I guess a certain ego drive. I don't know what makes people become conductors.
In your training of other students, you're giving back really what you have learned.
I try to.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any of your students that have excelled?
Yes, I would say a few. The first flute and the second flute of the Denver Symphonies, of the Denver Symphony,
mm-hmm.
are my students.
What are their names?
Pamela Bertoluzzi from McKeesport. And Marilyn Prestia is there.
That's the Army of TIA.
Mm-hmm. Eric Hoover was the principal flute of the San Antonio Symphony and has for many years been professor of flute at Arizona State in Tempe, Arizona. In more recent years, Lamar Hunt is a member of the Kansas City, Kansas City Symphony. And Barbara Basher, plays with the Jacksonville, Florida Symphony. Lawrence Ebert, E-B-E-R-T, teaches composition. I think at the University of Tacoma. John Monahan, M-O-N-A-G-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H-A-N-H- PA, Mansfield College, State College. Robert Pritchard is professor of flute in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Let's see. Eddie Schultz is freelancing in Philadelphia. Marcia Griglack is freelancing in New York. Patty Easterbrook is freelancing in Fort Lauderdale and Broward County, I guess. Well, I've got a lot, I mean, many, many more, but
mm-hmm, sure,
that I can't think of off panel.
Okay, just about out of time. Again, it's giving us more time than it's supposed to. So...
How are we finished then?
Well, we... okay, we have some more time on this tape.
We should finish that about Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
The differences, any other differences you have seen in Pittsburgh from when you first came to now? What about the public relations? You mentioned that Reiner and Steinberg were not very interested in the public relations, they were more interested in the music. Is that still true with Previn now coming in?
Well, Previn's forte, I think, was
public
relations.
Relations.
Yeah. I don't mean just on a one-to-one basis, but, you know, he knows, he's modern. That's what's happening. My former roommate, the black boy, is in advertising in Chicago. His current client assignment is Oldsmobile. And he says, listen, we can sell anything. You have to know how. So I think that the older type musician was more interested in the product, not in the sales pitch.
Are there any years that stand out in this symphony as having had been especially interesting, perhaps with the players that came, the artists?
Well, a few especially interesting things that we had, a Beethoven festival with Rudolf Serkin, in which he played all five piano concertos plus the choral fantasy in 3 days. Excuse me. And we did a couple of symphonies and a couple of overtures to round out the programs. Of course, Serkin played everything by memory, and Steinberg conducted everything by memory, but the choral fantasy, which is not done much except at the Marlboro, where it's played every year as the closing piece. And certainly some of my period spent up there, both in chamber music classes with Mr. Moise and in orchestra.